This is Ike Rayford.
And this is Shelby Pierce.
And we are Not a Monolith.
So, we are coming back from a bit of a hiatus for a pretty exciting special interview. Ike, you want to tell him?
Hey, we're back with Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
What? All right. So we are so excited to be back with you. This is just the beginning of us getting started again. So take a listen. We're so excited to see you.
Absolutely.
Talk to you.
Siouxland Public Media.
Yeah.
Mayor Pete, we are so excited and happy that you took the time out of your schedule to come to Siouxland and then, you know, stop in and talk to us. And so we're going to just jump in. I know some of the things that I want to specifically talk about is the Douglas Plan, and because it does really talk to our community.
Yeah.
And so we want to really hit on that. And then I know Shelby has some questions, and then we'll just kind of fill it out. So,
great.
So you know, first and foremost, why do you want to be president?
So I did not expect when I set out to run for mayor of my hometown at the beginning of this decade that by the end of this decade I'd be stepping forward for the presidency. What I see is a country that is dangerously divided, that is being torn apart largely because we have a divider in chief, but because of a lot of forces that are pulling us away from each other. And I'm thinking about what it'll be like that first day the sun comes up and Donald Trump is no longer president. We're going to need somebody who can unify and bring together this country. And we're also going to need somebody who can deliver big, bold, serious answers to major problems that have been with us all along. They didn't take a break for the impeachment process, from what's going on with the climate to a gun violence epidemic to racial inequality to the need to do better on health care. All of this needs big action. And the reason I'm running is because I know that so much depends for our country and especially for my generation to have a good future on us resolving right now, not 4 years from now, not 10 years from now, resolving these big policy challenges in a way that will actually help us unify as a nation. It's what your instinct is when you're a mayor.
Right.
I think coming from the middle of the country, coming from the Midwest, coming from the middle class is the kind of answer we need, not just to beat this president and get a new presidency, but also to deliver answers that are more responsive to what I think is the fundamental question on any voter's mind in any election, which is, how's my life going to be different if you're president instead of one of the others?
Right.
And what's propelling me in this campaign is the belief that we can build an American experience that is about belonging, not about exclusion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So tell us about this Douglas Plan. I mean, I know you put a lot of work into it, so give us the background and where we are with it.
Yeah, so the Douglas Plan, named after Frederick Douglass, who called our nation to be more than it is and to be truer to its creed. And the idea is, just like we had a Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe after World War II, we need a major investment, a major plan to deal with tearing down systemic racism and its effects here in the United States of America. That takes intention. It takes resources. We have learned the hard way, I think, that just moving from a racist policy to a neutral policy is not enough for equality to come about on its own, because these inequalities were created intentionally. I'm not just talking about the legacy of slavery. I'm talking about policies around housing, around access to things like the GI Bill and Social Security that played out within living memory. And so we've got to put a lot of intention into changing that. The idea of the Douglas Plan is to attack all of the different sources of inequality at the same time and to recognize that they're integrated. The cornerstone is economic empowerment, knowing that we have got to do more to deal with these inequities through intention. So, for example, one of the best track records of creating opportunity for black employees is black employers, minority-owned businesses.
Right.
And I'm proposing that the federal government do more with taxpayer dollars to purchase from minority-owned businesses. It means we got to support minority entrepreneurs who are emerging with college debt and relieve the college debt of those who are creating jobs. A number of steps we can make to make it easier to get credit and start a business. Those kinds of moves, in addition to things we know we've got to do for, look, not everybody's going to go start a business. This is why we need a higher minimum wage too,
right,
just take care of the basics. There's economic empowerment we got to do. We've got to do a lot around health. There are profound health inequities.
Yeah.
on everything from maternal mortality to diabetes to heart disease that show the effects not just of income disparities, but specifically of racial disparities in our health system. It's why we need a stronger civil rights function in the Department of Health and Human Services. And it's why we need to fund health equity zones where communities are developing solutions. Mm-hmm. Not all the solutions have to come from Washington, but more of the money should. And so I'm proposing that federal dollars support health equity zones. It's why we need to do something about housing. A lot of folks who have been redlined into certain neighborhoods, and then when those neighborhoods become desirable, they get gentrified right back out of them. It's why we need a what I call a 21st Century Homestead Act to help people take over sometimes vacant homes in the neighborhoods they grew up in. And we know a thing or two about vacant homes from our experience in South Bend, and we can take steps there. We need a 21st Century Voting Rights Act. We need major reform to the criminal legal system, which has huge disparities, especially around sentencing, the treatment of drug possession. I believe that incarceration should never be the response to simple drug possession. We know that the war on drugs has failed.
Yes.
And while America's going through a kind of enlightenment on the subject of opioids, which is great, mm-hmm. I think the question might be asked, where was this enlightened attitude when it came to things like the crack epidemic or sentencing disparities around marijuana? We got to have a whole overhaul that includes folks who are incarcerated now and look at cases where the incarceration is doing more harm than the original offense. In education, we got to be supporting HBCUs. We got to be directing Title I funds to schools where we know it'll make a difference. So my point is, there's a whole bunch there. And for folks who are interested, you can go to peteforamerica.com and read more of the details of it. But it's based on this central idea that we've got to work on all of these issues at once. We're not going to fix this overnight, but it's not going to get better on its own.
Right.
And good intentions are not enough. I'm mindful that there are a lot of well-intentioned, left-of-center, educated white guys like me, maybe who have been out there meaning well and saying the right things, and we're look at where we are as a country. And so it means that we got to have a conversation as a country. Part of why I knew we had to put forward this plan was because black voters are asking me, what is your agenda for black America?
Yes.
But also because we have to have a conversation with all of Americans about why everybody has a stake in getting this right, fixing it in our lifetime before it drags down the entire American project.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I didn't hear you talk about was around policing. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, for sure. And this is something that hits home for us because we've had a lot of challenges with this in my city. We had a police shooting this year that's still being investigated.
I was glad you had body cams.
We had the body camera, but it was not activated at the time. And of course, that defeats, in some ways, it's even worse because then people ask, why wasn't it on?
Yes.
You use your imagination to fill in the blanks of what happened. And so that led to a process where as a community, we brought people to the table, advocates sitting side by side with policymakers saying, all right, how do we improve our body camera policy? By the way, what needs to change in our use of force policy?
Yeah.
What needs to change in our recruiting? One area where we have really struggled, and I've owned up to this publicly because I know we're not the only city struggling, is recruiting a more diverse police department to begin with.
Yeah.
So that you have people who are not viewed as an occupying force in the neighborhoods that they're sworn to protect. And yes, it matters what the president is doing about this because I got to tell you, during the Obama administration, when we were struggling with issues around race and justice and policing, I could reach out to the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice and get support. The White House convened a whole task force on 21st century policing, led by Chuck Ramsey, who had been the chief in Philadelphia, doing a lot of really important work on accountability, on transparency, on the use of data, on the use of force. And that completely went away the moment that Trump took over for Obama. And so, yes, police decisions are made locally, but making sure that we have more accountability, making sure data gets out there, providing best practices, frameworks for discipline, also some legal things like do you continue to have a legal framework that essentially sends a message that most use of force will be considered justified, whether you can really justify it or not. That's going to change. And that requires national leadership, too. And having seen the consequences of having a wall of mistrust go up between law enforcement and communities of color, even where we haven't got it perfect back home, what we have gotten is a very clear understanding of what is needed and why things need to change from the White House on down.
Can you speak to the firing of your black police chief?
Yeah. So first thing I did when I took office was make key appointments. And mm-hmm. I appointed a police chief who was black. He had served under my predecessor, too, and was the first African-American police chief in our city's history. Unfortunately, later on that year, we got a visit from federal prosecutors looking into practices that had taken place under his watch before I became mayor. And in the context of that investigation, I lost confidence that he was the right person to serve as chief. It was a very painful moment in our community because there were a lot of reasons why he was appreciated and respected, even as we had a falling out over this issue. And so I've tried to be very clear about what our decision making was about. But part of this involved a set of recordings that was made before I became mayor in the police department that to this day there are people suing each other over whether we'll ever be allowed to listen to them. And it's a little bit like the body camera thing.
Right.
It's another example where in the absence of the information, without the transparency, it prompts people to assume the worst.
Right.
We don't know exactly what's on these recordings, but we know that has fed suspicions about whether there is racial bias among police officers. Now, none of the officers who are suing over these recordings are on the department now, but still, it affects the whole department and the whole community. And it's very important for me to be able to share that story and some of the things we learned the hard way as a result of that situation.
I'm sure it's not lost on you how incredibly complex tackling this is.
Yeah, and there's not going to be simple solutions sometimes.
Yeah.
But what we know is that the whole history, and this is not just a historical thing, but the present time, every week or two when you see one of these stomach-churning videos come over Twitter of something happening somewhere in this country in a violent encounter with a police officer, it affects the way that policing is viewed. And the real tragedy for this is if police are not viewed as legitimate in communities of color, then that makes it harder to fight violence among those who are most likely to be victims of violence from other civilians. Because we have cases, especially as we see young people subject to gun violence, where something happens and they take things into their own hands. You got a cousin, they go out and pretty soon it's a family fighting another family because nobody felt that the right decision would have been to turn to the police.
Right.
And so this has implications not just for those who are directly impacted in cases of police violence, but to the safety of a whole community.
Yeah. While we're discussing policing, I wanted to bring up gun control. Mm. A good friend of mine pointed out that you were in high school, as was I, when Columbine happened.
Yeah.
And then you've gone on to serve in the military. What is your position on gun control and the mass shootings that we experience regularly in this country?
I remember when we were in high school and Columbine happened, people saying never again, right? They were going to act and not let this happen again.
Wow.
And now when I go to an event and someone under the age of 18 raises their hand to ask a question, at least half the time it's about gun violence. And it represents such a failure that kids going to school are worried about their physical safety and that 20 or 30 years after this first became a kind of epidemic, we still haven't seen solutions. And we know what to do. I'm not saying we can prevent every single tragedy, but with universal background checks on guns, we will save lives. With red flag laws that identify people who are at risk, that disarm domestic abusers, we will save lives. And we've got to do something about the weapons that are being sold. Look, the kind of military equipment that I trained on when I was in uniform, or anything even resembling the weapon that I carried when I was in Afghanistan, that has no business being sold for profit anywhere near an American school or neighborhood. And we just got to have some common sense here. Now, the really striking thing to me is that most Americans are there. Most Republicans, most gun owners know that we ought at least to have background checks and these other measures too. And yet, just because it has a big majority with the American people, doesn't mean it can get a majority in the American Congress. To me, that's evidence of a deeper problem in our democracy. And we know what that problem looks like. It's districts that are drawn in ways that create extremes.
Yes.
It is the role of money in politics.
Yeah.
And so special interests capture the machinery of our government. It's why we got to reform not just our policies, but the way we make decisions.
Right.
And of course, the importance of democracy, of voting rights, of fair elections is especially resonant in the black community. I don't have to tell the African-American community about what's at stake in our democracy itself.
Right.
But for all Americans who care about these issues being handled better, we got to fix our democracy before it gets away from us.
Yeah.
How does, you know, in our community, we politicians come in and they say a lot of things. They give us that, you know, rosy picture. And there's two parts to this. One, how do you pay for all of that? Mm-hmm. And two, how do you make that happen?
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. Look, I talk to a lot of voters who feel like they've been kicked around by one party and taken for granted by the other. Or as one of our pastors back home put it, he said, you know, everybody knows how to come here to church before the election.
Right.
Yeah. And so I made a point of going to his church from time to time throughout my time as mayor. But this question of, okay, are we actually going to get results? And how are you going to do it? I believe that any candidate making big promises needs to explain how it's going to be paid for. And it's why we put out the revenue associated with every investment I'm proposing we make. First of all, it's why I'm careful what promises I make. I'm not saying free college for everybody. I'm saying let's make college tuition free for the first 80% by income. Anyone where cost would be a barrier. But I'm not going to say free for everybody because I want to make a promise I can keep. It's why we put together an answer on healthcare that still gets everybody covered. Medicare for all who want it was what I call it, but doesn't cost $20, $30 trillion. So we're being careful what we promise. What I promise does have a cost. I mean, the things we want to do, big investments on education, infrastructure, healthcare, you name it, has a cost. But we can raise the funds for that, mostly just by reversing the Trump tax cuts, which didn't go to most of us. They went to corporations and the wealthiest and didn't really do much to strengthen the fundamentals of our economy. We got to change that. We got to change capital gains taxes. We got to change the fact that the top few in this country pay less of their income on taxes than you and I do. Right. And we've got to be willing to raise revenue. This is not about going to some crazy, oppressively high level of taxes. It's just common sense that those who do best ought to pay their fair share. That's how you fund these things. How do you get through the politics of it? Well, that's one of the reasons we're campaigning on these things right now, so that nobody can be surprised when I take office and start pushing these things. I say, wait a minute, like the Douglas plan was a promise that I made before I even got the nomination. When the American people, if I am sworn in, I will be able to say when the American people voted for me, this is part of what the American people voted for.
Yes.
But we've also got to act on this as a country with a sense of urgency. And again, this is partly, frankly, a conversation I'm having with a lot of white Americans about why this is not a specialty issue.
Yeah, thanks for that. I appreciate it. I mean,
right, because this whole country is worse off as long as these inequalities persist. They're catching up. I mean, Russia has identified racial suspicion as a national security weakness of the United States of America.
Yes.
This weakens our country.
Absolutely.
Morally and practically.
Yes.
And we all have a stake in getting it done.
It it puts people on the defensive in this way that's so reactive. Something that I watched just in preparing for this interview, I was watching the town hall meetings that you were having after the shooting in the spring. Mm-hmm. And to watch you stand in the fire with the families that were frustrated and exhausted and angry, I want that in my leaders. Mm. I want, especially my white leaders, to be able to stand. There is a long, old history that's exhausting and it wears on a large amount of people in this country. And when it comes out, when we're given the opportunity to talk about it, it's aggressive. It is angry. Yes, it is frustrated. And that even comes out at the people who feel that they've positioned themselves to help.
Mm.
So I know, like, reading the Douglas plan, I'm excited about it. And the number one thing that comes up is it going to happen if you actually get elected?
Right.
We can't know that, right, unless you get elected.
That's true. Yeah, one way to find out for sure. But I take that point. I felt that, especially at that town hall you're talking about, where I understood that part of my job was to absorb a lot of anguish that was not just about what happened that day.
Yeah.
It was something that had piled up. And trying to not be too defensive. Because, look, when somebody's angry with you,
you want to defend yourself.
You go on defense. But remembering that this is not just anger over a moment. This is anger that is rooted in fear, and fear that is rooted in experience.
Yes.
And without pretending that I can understand it by standing there, if I can hear it, then I can do some good. And it's part of what we as a country have got to do. But at the end of the day, as you're saying, it's going to come down to results. Either you can measure whether we're going to succeed or not. You can tell whether it's getting better or not. Right now, by the numbers, we're in trouble. Black home ownership is at the lowest level it's been at since the Fair Housing Act was passed. The wealth gap is even bigger than the income gap. We've got a lot of things that we will be able to see in short order, whether this is getting better or whether it's getting worse. And I expect and welcome that I will be held accountable for that.
Exactly. Well, I know we're up on our time, but Shelby had we have to end with a fun question.
Wait a second. I got to ask for one more thing.
Okay.
So there have been two times with President Trump that I've had to go, okay. One was that I was one of the people who benefited from the tax break.
I didn't.
You didn't?
No, I didn't.
I work in a small office.
I paid more.
My coworker that does the payroll, she says, look, you got it. And I was like, ooh. Okay. And the bigger concern went to, would I give that money to see real growth and real progress in our functional programs? And the answer is yes, absolutely. Yeah. So it was nice. And while I appreciate it, I long for a system that works.
Right.
The second thing that I agreed with our commander-in-chief on was around the border, when there was the, whichever chat that was, where we talked about the security at the border, and he honed in on it being a humanitarian issue. I have been so frustrated that no one has said that illegal immigration is bad for all of us because of how vulnerable those people are. There is no, I cannot imagine the fear in someone who is undocumented and in this country, and the way that that does not give them access to if they're wronged or if when things happen, if you are afraid, you do not function in a good way. I want that. I want. I'm looking at the Democrats to do it, to champion the fact that this is a dangerous situation, and it's actually common ground that we have. It is not good for people to be in this country undocumented. There's different reasons why people believe that, right? My personal belief around that is how vulnerable the undocumented really are. And I want to see people, and if it happens to be Democrats, who step up to the plate on behalf of those people. What are some of your immigration policies that you want to put in place?
Yeah, I mean, this is why we need real reform, right? So the problem with the president and his allies is they talk out both sides of their mouth. They say they're for legal immigration and against illegal immigration, but actually they're making it harder to come to this country lawfully.
That's right.
And so we've got to do, look, my father came to this country through a process of lawful immigration, but that was 30, 40 years ago. Now the wait list, the backlogs, the bureaucracy are enormous. So we got to fix the lawful process. We've got to have a pathway to citizenship so that those folks you're talking about who are so vulnerable right now can come out of the shadows, whether we're talking about Dreamers or we're talking about 11 million people.
That's right.
And we got to manage the border in a way. Yes, we still have to have a border. This is not about getting rid of the border. It's about ending cruel practices at the border, like family separation, like the conditions in these detention centers that are just unconscionable, but also making sure that we're a country that honors our values and our laws, and we can do both.
Right.
We just got to make sure that our laws are up to date.
I think it's amazing the number of people who recognize the need for the labor force in this country, who utilize it, whatever way that looks like, who extend large amounts of trust, whether that's cleaning one's home or doing someone's landscape, and yet the general population of the United States has no idea what it takes to become a citizen.
Right. Oh, it's those tests, like it's.
Yeah, if I trust you in my house, I should be able to aid in your path to citizenship. Is my personal desire.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
Well, Romero P, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, anything else you want to add before we close?
Let me just encourage folks to follow me on Twitter, just my name, if you can spell it or close to it, or PeteForAmerica.com to learn more about what we're doing, and really welcome the opportunity to connect with you, to connect with Black voters across the country, and to connect with communities like Sioux City that remind me so much of home.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We appreciate you.
Thanks. All right.